طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Miko Peled is not Palestinian. In fact, he is culturally Jewish. His family's heritage is European and includes a grandfather who was a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence in May 1948, and a father who was a prominent general in the Israeli army in the 1960s and 1970s. But Miko Peled has become a staunch advocate for Palestinian rights and a fierce critic of apartheid Israel. Today we hear him speak in a broadcast sponsored by the Middle East Peace Now Forum, which originated in Minnesota. It begins with the introduction of Miko Peled.
Good morning, everyone. It is my pleasure to welcome and introduce this morning's speaker, Miko Peled. Miko is an author, writer, speaker, and human rights activist living in the United States. He is considered by many to be one of the clearest voices calling for justice in Palestine, support of the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, and the creation of a single democracy with equal rights in all historic Palestine. He is also a contributor to several online publications and produces the Miko Peled podcast, all of which he dedicated to advocating for the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. His first book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is an autobiographical work taking the reader throughout the life of Peled's family since his grandparents immigrated to Palestine in the early 20th century, describing their work and their life in detail while revealing his own journey towards a defender of Palestinian rights. His second book is Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. He travels regularly to Palestine, where he speaks and works with popular resistance, the BDS movement, and other justice groups. As a result, he has been arrested several times by the Israeli authorities for his activism. I have heard him speak before and have read his books. He is truly an inspiration. You are in for a treat this morning. Again, welcome, Miko.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the introduction and thanks for having me on this morning. I'm really pleased that this coalition has decided to, you know, puts together these lectures. I think we can't really be talking about Palestine, but we're not talking about it enough. And I think to continue to discuss, to continue to act, to continue to exchange ideas on how to move the issue of Palestine forward, particularly here in the United States, it cannot be overstated. So thanks for the opportunity. Now, I live here in Washington, D.C., and one of the most striking things here in Washington, D.C., in regards to Palestine, is that there is no Palestine. There's nothing representing Palestine. There's nothing advocating for Palestine. There's no building with a Palestinian flag. There used to be a PLO office in Georgetown, but that was closed. They were closed down and kicked out by Donald Trump. But even they, you know, they represented the Palestinian Authority, which really can't and doesn't deal with the main issues, the crucial issues of Palestine. So we're left with a yet another capital, probably the most important capital in the world. And there's nothing, there's no Palestine here. Palestine does not exist. Until recently, the building that used to host the, used to house the PLO mission, still had the flag on the flagpole, but you can imagine what the flag looked like after 4 years of just sitting there in the exposed to the elements. It was just in tatters. It was a string. I contacted the agent, and who's trying to sell. They're trying to sell the building, and even he was embarrassed. And so he ended up paying someone to take it off. It was just in tatters. It was an embarrassment. And so certainly it's symbolic. I mean, the reality here is that nobody talks about Palestine, nobody cares about Palestine, and there's no real push to discuss the crucial issues that plague Palestine. And the fact that there's no flag, and whatever flag there was just, you know, in tatters, is indicative of this reality. Now, I was in Palestine twice recently. I was there in May during the uprising. And then I was there again in July. And it's almost hard to put in words just how severe the situation is in Palestine. Because there's so little representation of Palestinian issues and Palestinian interests here in the United States, very often people will come to me and say, so, hey, it seems like everything's going great in Palestine. We're not hearing anything. Like, you know, these guys have worked it out or something. Like there's some kind of an agreement between the sides. And of course, that couldn't be farther from the truth. It's just that the situation is so severe. Israel has overpowered and continues to overpower Palestinians in a way that is so overwhelming that the Palestinian voice just cannot be heard. And of course, like I said, because there's no one here doing that, then that's the way it is here. But the situation could not be more severe. What we saw during the uprising in May, which, by the way, is something you might remember, was during Ramadan. It was kind of the later part of the month of Ramadan. We saw several things. We saw an uprising that swept through all of Palestine. We saw the Nakba, the entire southern part of Palestine, 60% southern Palestine. The Palestinian Bedouin were protesting in Lid, Ramle, Yaffa, Lid in particular. There was enormous activity, enormous protest, enormous violence that was perpetrated against Palestinians. In Jerusalem, of course, in Al-Aqsa, enormous amounts of violence, the desecration of Al-Aqsa, fires burning around the mosque. I know people who were in the mosque while the worshipers were being attacked by enormous numbers of military and police, or militarized police. In Nasra, in the north, in Akka, I mean, every part of Palestine stood up. And it was as though finally they were able to throw away this artificial two-state solution boundaries of somehow a West Bank and a non-West Bank, as though West Bank is Palestine and everything else is Israel. This uprising showed the world, anybody who cared to watch, and to pay attention, that there is one Palestine in its the entire historic Palestine, from the northern border with Lebanon to the Gulf of Aqaba and Rashrash, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. It is one country. It is one nation. It is Palestine. They are Palestinians. And they stood up. And just to make it absolutely clear, they were heavily punished. Thousands of Palestinian citizens of Israel who participated were arrested. Many of them were charged with security violations, so they're being treated as terror threats. The beatings, just casual beatings of Palestinian citizens of Israel on their way to work, on the streets, on campuses. I was in Be'er Saba in the south, in the Nakba with some Palestinian activist friends. One had just come out of 3 days of torture in the Shabak dungeons. still bruised. We went to the court in Be'er Sheva where, dozens of Palestinians were being charged. And many of these Palestinians were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So this particular place, this particular instance where I was at court, these guys were on campus at the university in Be'er Sheva, and they were beaten by a mob of Israelis. And there was a clear movement of kind of the settler, West Bank settler movement people moving into what they call the mixed cities in 1948. So that'd be Be'er Sheva, that'd be Yaffa, Ramleh, where you have both Israelis and Palestinians. And they came in, these settlers came in armed and by the hundreds, ready to beat up and kill and provoke. But that was never reported that way. It's always reported as though the Palestinians instigated violence. So it was an uprising of the likes of which we hadn't seen in a very long time. And Palestinians are being punished regardless of where they live. They're being punished the same way as the torture, the beating, the arrests, home demolitions, and on and on. There's no difference where Palestinians live anymore. They're Palestinians, and it's obvious that the way Israelis view them, they're the enemy. And they stood up, and this was I think a great moment in the history of the Palestinian resistance. But the problem is that, and then of course there was an enormous bombing of Gaza. You know, it was people in Gaza. I was in Jerusalem while bombs were being dropped on Gaza, and I was texting with people in Gaza at the time, and people in Gaza were saying that they had never experienced anything. There were so many attacks and so many bombings in the past. They were saying that this one was particularly punitive and harmful, which is almost impossible to understand. Of course, many people were killed. Many civilians were killed all the time by Israel. And then there were protests. And then the protests that came after the uprising and after the bombing on Gaza ended, or even during, were really quite incredible. I mean, the numbers were unprecedented. And that's really also indicative of the problem. We always stand up and we always protest and we always speak up after the fact. And between attack and attack, there's nothing going on, or there's very little going on. And that's a big part of the problem. We, and when I say we, I mean all people of conscience, really. Anybody, people of conscience around the world, it doesn't matter if they're Palestinians or Israelis or Americans or anybody else. People of conscience need to stand up every single day with the objective of preventing the next attack, with the objective of preventing the next detention of Palestinians, preventing the next Palestinian child who's going to go through torture in the dungeons of the Israeli Shabak. And more strategically, with the intention of demanding that not a single bullet, not a single gun, not a single tank, every time Israel bombs Gaza, they need to replenish their arms. We need to make sure that not a single bomb, not a single rocket is ever sent to Israel again. And we need to start doing this right now. And if we don't stand and start making these demands, then we're going to be talking about this next year and then the next year. And then our children are going to be talking about this. And this is going to go on and on and on. And what I see with Palestinian friends of mine, you know, almost all my Palestinian friends spent years in prison. Now their kids are spending years in prison. One of the experiences that I had, a good friend, Iyad Burnat, who many people know because he's been to the U.S. and spoke, he's from Bil'ain. He was one of the leaders of the civil disobedience and the marches, the Friday marches in Bil'ain for years. And he was beaten and punished severely for this. And now his children were arrested. And I remember these kids when they were too young. They were so young that their dad wouldn't allow them to come to the protests. Now these 19, 20-year-olds are the ones being arrested and tortured. And two of his boys, were detained, held for over 50 days. One was released after 52 days, the other with no charges. And when he was released, another friend of mine, Bassem Tamimi, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, and I went to visit him in Belin and to see the boy. And, you know, this fine-looking young man, around 20 years old, dressed well, looks great. And Bassem asked him, so how was the, you know, how was the arrest? How was the Maskubiya? The Maskubiya is where they hold Palestinians. It's the police headquarters and the Shabak torture chambers in Jerusalem. And by the way, it's right in the center of Jerusalem, surrounded by bars and restaurants and cafes and stuff. It's disgusting how close it is to how Israelis get to this and don't care. And as soon as Bassem asked him, so how's the Maskubiya? You saw the look on this young man's face that was a look of horror. It was a look of such horror. It lasted a moment, but a very brief moment. But it was such horror that, you know, this kid went through hell. He was in hell and he came back somehow. And then he began describing, you know, 20 hours of seated in extremely painful positions. And I asked him, 20 hours of interrogation a day? What do they ask you for 20 hours? And he goes, no, they don't ask you questions for 20 hours. You sit in the room for 20 hours. And every so often, somebody comes in, asks you a question, and leaves you. And the entire time, of course, you're exposed to light and noise. And so now it's a whole new generation. And this was true, by the way, in 1948 Palestine. It's a whole new generation. It's a whole new generation of young Palestinians who are now standing up and protesting and being tortured and beaten and killed. And how many more generations are we going to allow this to continue? Because at the end of the day, there's not going to be somebody else who's going to stop it. It has to be us. If we act, there's a chance it will stop. If we don't act, it's never going to stop. And Israel is on a mission. And when we look back at the last 100 years, it's obvious that Israel and the Zionist movement in general are on a mission, and they are very, very successful. They won the PR war, you know, in a spectacular way. They won the military war in a spectacular way. They're destroying the country to eliminate anything that might remind people that there was a Palestinian history, and they're doing it wholesale. It's one of those things, again, that goes, you know, under the radar, unnoticed, nobody talks about, but the country is being monuments, cemeteries, mosques. We know about, you know, entire villages and towns that had a huge, rich history being completely destroyed and demolished. And the only history that people talk about is not really a history, but it's kind of the biblical Zionist mythology. The Jews were there, the Jews came back, and nothing else happened in Palestine ever really of any kind of significance. So Israel is winning spectacularly on all fronts. Unless we stand up and reverse that, nothing's going to change. Now, I mentioned Al-Aqsa because the attacks on Al-Aqsa in May were far worse. The desecration was far worse than anything they've done before. And they've attacked and they've shot and they've been, you know, they've gone into the mosque many, many times and shot people and so on. But this was during Ramadan. And to do this during Ramadan is taking everything to a whole new level. And I want to talk about Al-Aqsa and Jerusalem for just a moment. If you've been to Jerusalem, you know there's these alleys, all these streets that lead to Al-Aqsa, but they're open only for Muslims. And if you want to go as a guest, there are visiting hours, and you need to go through the Western Wall, through the Jewish Quarter, and then there's a bridge that leads up to the grounds of Al-Aqsa. And you used to just be able to, you know, go through a simple security check, and you go through that bridge. So I went, but now you walk up the bridge, and about halfway the bridge down up the bridge, they stop you. And it's a closed bridge. It's a covered bridge. They stop you, and you have to wait for a tour with an enormous military escort or police escort, but heavily armed police. They look like military. And in that space where you wait, there's an enormous model of the new temple, the third temple, the Jewish temple that is to be built instead of Al-Aqsa. And then you wait, and these tours are just really tours for these settler types who are praying for the destruction of Al-Aqsa and the building of a new temple. So it's a whole movement. And this is what it is. I was shocked. So I had to stay there, wait for the, you know, for the, I guess they wait for a certain number of people, and off you go with this enormous, enormous armed entourage. And even though they say you're not supposed to pray, you're not supposed to wear religious symbols, every few meters they stop and pray. And the entire trip is really about prayer. It's about them going on the Al-Aqsa compound and engaging in a religious service or religious ceremony. And then there's a particular place where they stop for about half an hour, protected by the police. And I asked one of the cops, I said, what are we doing here? Why was, I thought we're not supposed to pray there. The prayer is not allowed, because they say this before you enter the grounds. And he's just like, you know, shrugged his shoulders. And I said, how long is it going to take? And he says, well, you know, a few more minutes, and then the tour is over soon anyway. And another thing that happens during these tours is the compound is completely closed to anybody else. It's like, it's abandoned. It looks like it's abandoned. It's very strange, because if you've ever been there, there are always a lot of people. Teachers bring their classrooms there. People go there bring their kids for a picnic. Kids play around. It's enormous ground. It's beautiful. And people use it. You know, people work there. People, of course, come to worship. And it was desolate, except for these settlers who are absolute loonies, and me, and this enormous entourage of armed police. Now, 20, 30 years ago, everybody knew there was a small group of the Temple Mount loyalists and the Temple Mount Institutes and movement, and they were a bunch of crazies that wanted to build a temple. Over the last couple of decades, this movement has become incredibly, incredibly big and popular, to the point that even Israeli TV did a documentary about them and revealed that over the last couple of years, these tours had over 50, 60, 80,000 people taking these tours. And these are regular, non-religious Israelis. And then after I came back from this tour, from this very, very bizarre experience, I mean, the place is enormously beautiful. I mean, it's really spectacular if you've not been there. But several thoughts came to me as I was thinking about this, as I was kind of going through this in my head. First one was that actually the destruction of Al-Aqsa and the building of a temple is a big part of the secular national Zionist project. It is something that has been injected into all Israelis. I'll give you a few examples. I remember as a child, you know, we used to sing these silly folk songs, and many of them talked about the day where we build the temple, where we build the temple, and we celebrate our holidays at the temple. I'm not talking about religious people. I'm talking about completely secular Israelis. Then I was thinking about the time of the 1967 war, the Six-Day War. And I was asking other Israelis this as well. What is the most iconic sentence, the one thing that everybody remembers from that war? And it's this one sentence that, again, became iconic. When the commander of the Israeli paratroopers took Jerusalem, when they got up onto to Al-Aqsa, he said over the radio, "Harabayit bi'adenu," the Temple Mount is in our hands. And I'm not a religious man, and so on and so forth, but this is a great moment for our people, for our history. We have returned, and so on and so forth. In other words, this has nothing to do with religion. This is a national secular national Zionist. One of the objections. One of the goals. One of the objectives of this movement, of the State of Israel. And it goes across religious, secular, Ashkenazi, Sephardic. I mean, it crosses all the different parts of Israeli society. And I did this experiment. I just asked people, what do you remember from the war? What is the one thing that springs to mind? Even people who were not alive then. Oh, yeah, that one sentence that this particular commander said over the radio when they took the temple mount of the Al-Aqsa compound. And then I don't know if people here are familiar with the famous song, Jerusalem of Gold. And it was written by Israel's most popular songwriter, Naomi Shemer, and who also happened to be a close family friend. And when she wrote the song, it became enormously popular. The song was commissioned 2 weeks before the war. And as some of you may know, there was an enormous push to promote the idea of the war. There was, the Israeli government were hesitant, the military and others wanted the war, the 1967 war, to start the war. And this song was obviously part of the propaganda to push for the war. And it talked about, this Jerusalem, this wonderful city who is sitting desolate on a hill. Nobody visits the marketplaces. Nobody worships on the Temple Mounds. The water wells have dried up. And of course, we know that millions of Palestinians were frequenting this before 1967. So that was the song. It came out 2 weeks before the war. It was incredibly popular. About a month later, in other words, a few weeks after the war, she added a few stanzas where she made some changes, where she says, now the streets of the marketplace are full. They're bustling with people. The water wells are flowing again. And now we see the worshipers back on Har HaBayit, back on the Temple Mount. And she was a completely secular Zionist Israeli. So this idea of destroying Al-Aqsa and building a temple is not a fringe radical idea. It is a consensus. It's part of the Zionist national consensus. It's one of the objectives. And as we look at Palestine in general, like I said earlier, mosques and ancient cemeteries and churches and anything that demonstrates that there was a history that is not the Zionist narrative, not the history that the Zionist narrative tries to push forward, but an actual other history, a Palestinian history, anything that demonstrates that is being either allowed to fall into disrepair or being destroyed. You may have seen there was a video that came out a week or two ago of a mother holding on to the grave of her son as Israeli forces are destroying this Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem. This is part of that. They're destroying all these historic cemeteries. They're just throwing out the bones of families and people who, have been burying their loved ones there for 1,000 years or more. And they're building a biblical park or something. And it's part of this Judaizing of all Jerusalem, Zionizing and bibliizing, if you will, the narrative and what you see when you visit Jerusalem. So they're reducing anything that has to do with Palestine, and they're aggrandizing anything that has to do with the biblical narrative, the biblical mythology. Al-Aqsa is, of course, very high profile, a little more complicated. But during the month of May, when the Israeli troops were storming the mosque, there was a particular day where there were thousands of Israeli youth in the plaza near the Western Wall, in front of the Western Wall, dancing and singing. And because of the shooting and the grenades and the stun grenades and tear gas that was being shot inside and around the mosque, there was a fire that broke out right next to the mosque. So there was this visual of a fire next to the mosque and thousands of young Israelis dancing with the Israeli flag right below it. And I don't know how that did not just create a sense of enormous fear in everybody around the world. that is the doomsday scenario. That's exactly what it's going to look like. And it's going in that direction. It's heading in that direction with tremendous speed. It is not going to take much for Israel to allow Al-Aqsa to be destroyed and then proceed to build this temple. It's part of the consensus. The people who were once these fringe religious lunatics are now not only in the Knesset, but many of them are in the government now. I mean, the prime minister was the chairman of the West Bank settlers movement. Not that Netanyahu before him was, I think, was any different, any worse, but I mean, this he wears a kippah, so he's kind of a religious man, so that kind of adds a little bit to it. I'm sure Netanyahu would have no problem seeing Al-Aqsa burn and building a temple in it instead. One representing, you know, Netanyahu representing this kind of secular Israeli Zionist fascism, and the other one, Bennett, representing the more religious Zionist form of Zionist fascism. And really, that's the only discourse that takes place now in Israel is between these two groups. I mean, there are the religious Zionist fascists, and then there are the secular Zionist fascists, and they're just vying for power. Who gets to sit in the seat in terms of policy, in terms of how they see Palestine and the history and the future? There's no difference, really. So in terms of our concern for the future of Palestine, it makes no difference who seats in the prime minister's chair. But if we look at the way Zionists have operated over the last 75 years and even more, there's always a small group of somehow more radical, more zealot young people that create the facts on the ground. And then the kind of the more official establishment agrees. And if it's too egregious, maybe they'll distance themselves first and then they'll accept it. You know, the massacre of Deir Yassin, for example, in 1948, at first the official, you know, establishment kind of distanced themselves from it. But then, of course, they didn't do anything to prevent other massacres. And they kind of, you know, took advantage of the benefits of the massacre, if you will. The same thing when the settlements began in the West Bank after 1967. The small group of radicals started it. And then the government came in and said, you know what, actually, you know, we support it. And of course, they supported it, even though supposedly ideologically there was some kind of a difference between them. And this is what's going to happen now. It's going to be some fluke, some accident, and I've seen plenty of fires started by tear gas grenades, tear gas canisters. And there'll be a fire and forget for a moment the religious significance of Al-Aqsa. Think of this structure that has been crowning this city, Jerusalem, for 1,500 years. It's glorious. It's magnificent. It's beautiful. It's historically so significant. I mean, I thought, okay, let's see, what do we compare it to? Compare, for example, say the Taj Mahal, which is much young, you know, not as old, not as significant, and I think not nearly as beautiful. Imagine somebody, if there was a movement to destroy the Taj Mahal and build something else instead. I mean, people would think it was absurd. Here, this is in Jerusalem, in Al-Aqsa, in the case of Al-Aqsa, this is, I'm telling you, in all honesty, this is where this is going. Now, the fact that nobody is noticing the lead up only makes it worse because people aren't realizing that there is a lead up to this. Other important mosques, other important monuments have been either destroyed or allowed to fall into disrepair. Al-Aqsa is a national symbol that Israelis are crying to see it destroyed. Now, for most of us, we see Al-Aqsa, we see the Golden Dome, the Dome of the Rock, we think, wow, this is glorious. They see it as an eyesore. They want to build and then operate this thing that they call a Jewish temple. And by the way, there are government-sponsored programs where young people who choose not to go to the army but choose national service instead can opt to go to be taught and trained on how to operate the temple once it's in place. How to conduct the slaughter of the sheep and how to conduct the slaughter of the cows and, well, what to do with the blood and where to put the incense. I mean, how to operate this whole thing and where do the priests go? So there's a government program with thousands of young Israelis who are being trained on how to operate this temple once it's there. Government sponsored, never mind all these other, you know, billions of dollars that go into this movement as a movement. But all of this just to say the situation in Palestine is so severe and is getting more and more severe by the day. And all we hear about is from time to time, oh, Israel approved another 3,000 units of, housing units in East Jerusalem. Or, from time to time, we'll hear about hunger strikers when it actually reaches the news. It doesn't often reach the news, but, hunger strikers. Or maybe some egregious form of, Israel bombed Gaza. We hear about that, but we don't really talk about anything else. We don't hear about anything else. I'll say what I said earlier. Again, we are, if we do not step up, if we do not demand of our elected officials that they distance themselves, at least, if not totally reject Zionism and the state of Israel, then we are failing our duty as people of conscience. Anybody who runs for office, school board, city council, sheriff, state legislatures, and of course, national office, must hear from us, must understand that we demand sanctions against Israel, that we demand boycott against Israel, that we demand that not a single bullet, not a single gun, tank, warplane, or any other instrument of death be sent to Israel ever again. Not a single dollar go to the state of Israel ever again. Or that particular elected official will be shamed, will be exposed as a supporter of racism and violence and brutality against innocent people. We need to step up our game, or else there will never be any change. Elected officials need to be scared to say they support Israel. They need to be terrified that somebody will associate them with Zionism. They need to do everything they possibly can to make sure we know that they reject Israel, and they will do everything they can to stop sending money and weapons to this monstrous apartheid regime that is murdering Palestinians, murdering children, murdering women, murdering innocent civilians, and destroying what is a glorious history, a country with an enormously important and made enormous contributions to the world throughout history, throughout thousands of years. That is what is imperative. That is what we must be doing. Not go out and protest after the fact. The people in Gaza were already dead by the time everybody was out protesting. The bombs had fallen. Hamas is not the issue. When I flew in May, Hamas, the Qassam rockets were everywhere. So the airport wasn't closed, but none of the airlines were flying in. So I was rerouted. I flew to Amman and I crossed overland, which adds a couple of days to the trip. But the major airport of the state of Israel was not functioning for about 10 days or 2 weeks. And then we're surprised that people, support Hamas. We need to demand that airlines don't fly to Tel Aviv, period, because they boycott Tel Aviv. Not wait for Hamas from Gaza, where people have barely food to eat and water to drink and medicine for their children if they have a toothache. Not demand they do it. We need to initiate it. We do nothing, and when Palestinians act, they get blamed for using violence. If we acted, they wouldn't need to do this. If we were in the streets before the attack, if we were in the offices of our elected officials before the attack, they wouldn't need to do this. And then be blamed for using armed resistance, for using violence. What are they expected to do? If we did our job, Tel Aviv Airport would be desolate. Not through rockets, but through people, voting with their feet, saying we will not use airlines that go to Tel Aviv. In the 2021 Olympics in Tokyo, there was a judo practitioner from Algeria who refused to compete against the Israeli team member Now, if we stop for a moment to think how hard he must have worked to get to the Olympics. And he said, no, I will not shake hands. I will not get on the mat with a member of the Israeli team. And it was an enormous sacrifice. He was thrown out of the Olympics, and he and his coach were suspended from any judo competitions for the next 10 years. Well, that means it's the end of his career as an Olympic athlete. That's an enormous sacrifice, a personal sacrifice. But until the Olympic Committee stands up and bans Israel from participating in the Olympics, that's what needs to be done. Athletes need to refuse to participate in the Olympics as long as the state of Israel is allowed to participate. And they need to refuse to get on the mat or get on the field or whatever field they're in, refuse to participate in any event that includes an Israeli team member. If we do these things, which are not violent, which are not armed, where nobody gets hurt, the Palestinians wouldn't have to, you know, shoot rockets out of Gaza. But we tend not to, obviously we're not doing this. So what's left? And really, you know, there's a lot more the Palestinians do than shoot rockets out of Gaza. I mean, the Palestinians are resisting as best they can. But if three Palestinians wanted to get together from three parts of the country, say one from Jerusalem, one from Lid, one from Hebron, they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it, number one, because logistically it's impossible. It's illegal because of the checkpoints. And within 5 minutes, between the secret police of the Palestinian Authority and the secret police of the Israelis, they'd be put in jail. We can do this. We can meet anywhere we want. We can talk about anything we want. We can put together a strategy. We can find a house here in Washington, D.C., put a big Palestinian flag and make it a center for Palestinian activity. And I'm not talking about reopening the PLO office, which is completely useless. But not completely. I mean, they do deal with visa issues that help Palestinians a little bit. But in terms of these larger issues, they never deal with refugees. They never deal with prisoners. We don't see members of Congress getting briefings about the situation of refugees, about demanding that Resolution 194 be implemented. And by the way, an excellent book that came out, more like a research paper about a year ago, called The Palestinians in International Law. The Palestinian Refugees in International Law. And I wrote about it and I interviewed the writers in one of my webinars earlier last year, if anybody wants to check it out. Resolution 194 is one of the most important historic resolutions in the history of the United Nations. It has been reaffirmed more than any other resolution in the history of the United Nations. And in this book, it speaks precisely of what was taken and what Palestinians deserve to get back. I don't know if there are any Palestinians in the audience, but in Arabic, they say, "Akhaduha mafrusha." They stole it furnished. They took it fully furnished. You know, the Nakab, the Bedouin, the Nakab were exporting barley to England. When we look at aerial photos of the Nakab, which people think is a desert, it is a desert, but it's a fertile desert, you see enormous tracts of cultivated land. I'm talking about, you know, when the British occupation began. Throughout history, Palestinians were exporting cotton and olive oil to Europe, cotton to the garment industry in the UK. It was a powerhouse. There were cities, spaces, you know, public spaces. They stole the produce from the fields. They stole money that was in the banks. They stole institutions and they stole agricultural machinery. They took everything, not just the houses, the land, and the water. It's estimated in billions and billions of dollars what the Zionists stole when they took Palestine in 1948. They didn't take a barren land and made it bloom. They took a country that was in full bloom and stole it. That's what the Zionists did. They didn't make the desert bloom. They only caused destruction. And now the Bedouin Palestinians in the Nakba are forbidden to engage in agriculture, while the wealthiest agriculture communities, and the wealthiest cities in Israeli cities and towns and farms are in the Nakam. The highest standard of living among Israelis is in the Nakam. And the poorest Palestinians, who are prohibited from building on their land, from cultivating their lands and so forth. Another thing I did, and I did an interview with this wonderful city councilwoman from the city of Lid. And maybe I'll finish with this because we're kind of running out of time. But and if you check out my Patreon page, her name is Fida Shahada. Incredibly courageous young woman. And during the uprising in May, she came to some prominence because she was out there, you know, talking to the press a lot, because a lot was taking place in Lid, and hundreds, about 500 settlers came into Lid, settled in the city, in the city hall, armed, and they were there to kill and provoke, and they killed a Palestinian. Two Palestinians were shot. One was killed. One was seriously injured, and there's been no investigation, of course. So I interviewed her, and we went through the city. She took me on a tour. We went around. And we were talking about home demolitions, and she remembers as a younger woman seeing home demolitions and wondering about that, and that drove her to study city planning and then come back to the city and run for city council. And then she challenged the mayor, who was a racist, fascist, settler type. And we're talking about home demolitions, and she was saying that there are currently some 40,000 home demolition orders. And I said, wow, that's a lot. Is that, you know, that's for all of Palestine? She said, no, that's not all of Palestine. It does not include the Nakab, which is 60% of the country, because the Nakab is governed by a separate bureaucracy. And the Nakab alone, over the last few years, they've demolished over 2,000 homes per year. And that's the ones demolished. It's not the ones that have a demolition order. These 40,000 orders don't include the Nakab, don't include the West Bank, don't include Jerusalem. It's just for the 1948 northern part, you know, from the center moving up. Less than half, I don't know, maybe a fourth of the population of Palestine, Palestinian population of Palestine. You know, the violence, the racism, the brutality, the incredibly one-sided racist discourse, the lack of any really serious dissent is mind-blowing. It's insane. It's Sparta. That's really the only way to describe Israel. And unless we, and I said this earlier and I'll say this again, unless we stand up, unless we demand our elected officials to completely distance themselves, reject Israel and Zionism, unless we demand that they do everything in their power to make sure not a single dollar, not a single bullet goes to Israel ever again, things are going to get progressively worse because there's no status quo. It's an ongoing, it's like Roman legions going through the country and ruining everything in sight. That's what is happening in Palestine, from the north to the south, from the east to the west. Israel is destroying everything it possibly can. So I want to encourage everybody to get up, invite people to get up and do things. I think that the possibility, the future of Palestine can be promising. The history of Palestine was glorious. I don't know if you've ever seen or read the book by Nur Masalha, the Palestinian historian Nur Masalha. It's called Palestine, a 4,000-year history. Read it. One of the things he demonstrates in that book is that the name Palestine has been used to describe that country going back 4,000 years. The Egyptians, the Greeks, Aristotle, Herodotus, on and on and on, the Assyrians have always referred to this country by the name Palestine. And then he talks about the details as well. I mean, you know, the details of the history, which are remarkable. It's a remarkable country. It's got a glorious history. And so the future can be bright because Palestine is a great place and a lot of great people live there. But it's governed by a radical, racist, violent regime, which is called the State of Israel. And just like people stood up against apartheid in South Africa, they should stand up against Israel in Palestine. The entire structure, the entire power structure needs to change. Palestine needs to be decolonized. It needs to be democratized. We need to stop all these ridiculous conversations about a two-state solution or a separation or anything that gives any legitimacy to the State of Israel. The State of Israel should be completely delegitimized. Zionist ideology should be completely delegitimized. Anyone who recognizes or who considers themselves a Zionist should not be allowed a seat at the table. Just like anybody who is a fascist or a white supremacist is not allowed a seat at the table. This, and we need to change the narrative, change the story to a place where people realize that Zionism needs to be in the same column as all other forms of racism and fascism and supremacy. Not only is it not anti-Semitic to oppose Zionism, it's anti-Semitic to support Zionism. It's racist. You know, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. If you support anybody who supports Zionism is supporting racism. And talk to Orthodox Jews about how they suffer from the Zionists and how they've opposed Zionism from the very beginning and why. It's a whole other issue that I'm working on a book about that right now. It's an incredible story of courage and foresight by the entire ultra-Orthodox community around the world that saw very early on that Zionism will bring only violence to the Holy Land and ruin the good relations that used to exist between Jews and Arabs and Jews and Muslims, not only in Palestine and the rest of the Arab world too, but particularly in Palestine. So it's insulting to even engage in the conversation of whether or not opposing Zionism is anti-Semitic. But supporting racism can be somehow construed as good for Jewish people? Zionism is a racist ideology. It belongs in the same column as all other racist, fascist, supremacist ideologies. It should be opposed completely. And this entire conversation of whether or not it's anti-Semitic should be set aside. It's an insult to anybody who ever suffered from racism or anti-Semitism to engage in this conversation. So going back to my summation, I'll say I want to invite everybody to participate in the struggle. I want to invite everybody to demand that elected officials be part of the struggle. We have to change the way things are done here in Washington, D.C. We have to change the way any congressman, like I said, any elected official views this issue and acts on this issue. And we need to set in front of our eyes this image of a free, democratic Palestine with equal rights, with the right of return. This great organization, Zuchrot, has a project called Envision Return, where they're envisioning the return, where young Palestinians are kind of, you know, creating images of what the villages will look like once the return happens, once they're rebuilt. How the return will happen. And demand a conversation about the return, about the prisoners, about justice, about equality, and about a free, democratic Palestine. Or as somebody wrote somewhere, make Israel Palestine again. Then we will all see the peace and the justice that we're looking for. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Miko Peled speak at a forum sponsored by Middle East Peace Now. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time and hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.